The young lady seemed nervous as she looked around the pawn shop in downtown Chicago. The shop had a little bit of everything. There were cameras, radios, and a wide selection of jewelry. Engagement rings and wedding bands were on display. Tokens of relationships that didn't quite make it. "Can I help you, miss?" the man behind the counter said. "Yes," she responded. "I am interested in purchasing a gun of some type." I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. Edward Stephen Waitkus was born September 4th, 1919, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Cambridge is a suburb of Boston. His parents were Veronica and Stephen Waitkus, Lithuanian immigrants who met and fell in love on their passage to America. Eddie grew up with a younger sister, Stella, in a modest flat in East Cambridge. He first learned to play baseball at Cambridge Field, a neighborhood park not far from his home. He was a natural right-hander and liked to pitch, but he didn't have a glove, so he first played barehanded. Eddie's father was a butcher, and while he didn't understand this American game of baseball, he liked that his family was assimilating to life in the United States. On Eddie's 8th birthday, Stephen bought Eddie a first baseman's glove. Eddie was thrilled with the glove, but he didn't have the heart to tell his father he was a pitcher, not a first baseman, and that the glove was for a left-handed thrower. Instead, Eddie taught himself how to throw left-handed and became a first baseman. At Cambridge Field, Waitkus came under the tutelage of Jack Burns, who had played first base in the big leagues for 7 years with the St. Louis Browns and the Detroit Tigers. Burns, whose Big Lear career was ending in 1936, just as Eddie was preparing for his senior year of high school, taught Eddie the finer points of first base play. Now, Eddie's childhood was not just school and baseball. When he was 14 years old, his mother died of pneumonia. This meant Eddie had to help raise his younger sister, Stella. In addition to the chores around the house, Eddie worked with his father at the butcher shop in the summer and on weekends. And despite the untimely death of his mother, Eddie went on to be an honor student at Cambridge Latin High, where he studied foreign languages, was a star debater, and graduated 6th in a class of 600 students. When Eddie was a sophomore, he walked into a baseball practice with his trusty first baseman's mitt, only to be told by the coach that the team already had a first baseman. Eddie asked the coach to at least let him take a few grounders, and after he scooped up everything hit his way, he was told to grab a bat. Eddie proceeded to smack line drives all over the park, and just like that, the team had a new first baseman. Eddie excelled in the classroom and on the baseball diamond. He hit 600 his senior year, including a home run that landed on top of a three-story apartment building just beyond the right field fence. Eddie was named to every all-scholastic team in the Boston area in 1937, and that summer played in the semi-pro Suburban Twilight League. He considered accepting a scholarship to play baseball at either Harvard, Holy Cross, or Duke, but playing for the Warumbo Indians of Lisbon Falls, Maine in the Fast Maine League during the summer of 1938 changed any college plans. Eddie played exceptionally well. He was the top prospect in New England that summer. His club won the Maine championship and qualified for the National Baseball Congress tournament in Wichita, Kansas, where they won 2 games before being eliminated. After the young first baseman was named by Major League Scouts to an All-American semi-pro team, Boston sports writer Fred Berry wrote, "These big league wise men viewed the left-handed batting and throwing of 19-year-old Eddie Waitkus and termed him a natural." Ralph Wheeler, a sports writer with the Boston Herald, was friends with the Chicago Cubs manager Gabby Hartnett and asked him to give Eddie a look. This would lead to a contract and a $2,500 bonus for Eddie to sign with the Cubs. Eddie was then assigned to Moline of the Class B League. Eddie got off to a slow start at Moline, perhaps because he'd never played night baseball before, and after 8 weeks he was hitting only 189. But then Eddie hit his stride and finished with a .326 batting average and a dozen triples, making the league's all-star team while playing for a seventh-place team. His performance earned Eddie a promotion to the Tulsa Oilers of the Class A Texas League for 1940, he adjusted to the faster league quite well, batting .303 in 162 games and leading the league with 192 hits. While in Tulsa, Eddie got to know star pitcher Dizzy Dean, who was in Tulsa rehabbing from a shoulder injury. Eddie and Dizzy became fast friends, and Dizzy would sing Eddie's praises when he returned to the major leagues. This was a friendship which would endure the rest of their lives. Now, Eddie struggled in 1940, but by 1941, he had adjusted to the Pacific Coast League and was tearing the cover off the ball. Eddie was called up to the majors in September 1941 and looked like a lock as the Cubs' starting first baseman in 1942. Of course, that all changed on December 7, 1941. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and America was at war. Eddie spent the next 3 years serving with the U.S. Army in the Pacific Theater. He served with the 544th Engineering Boat and Shore Regiment. He saw heavy combat in New Guinea and the Philippines. Eddie survived bloody initial beach landings on the Solomon Islands and the Philippines, where he narrowly escaped being taken prisoner by the Japanese. When the war was over, Eddie had 10 meritorious service awards, including 4 Bronze Stars. He was 26 years old when he reported to Catalina Island for the Cubs' 1946 spring training after nearly 3 years of military service. However, the Cubs had a first baseman, Phil Cavaretta, who was coming off a batting championship and a National League Most Valuable Player award. Cavaretta had been exempt from military service because of a perforated eardrum. Once the season began, Cubs right fielder Bill Nicholson struggled at the plate, and soon Cubs manager Charlie Grimm moved Cavaretta to right field, opening up first base for Eddie. Eddie would finish the season with a .304 batting average, the only Cub regular to hit over .300. Eddie finished 13th in the National League MVP race. Now serving as the Cubs' first baseman, Waitkus battled injuries early in 1947, but when he was there, he hit for a solid average, typically second in the batting order. After losing 4 seasons due to World War II, it appeared Eddie Waitkus' baseball career was back on track. Eddie and his teammates, Marv Rickert and Russ Meyer, became fast friends. The trio enjoyed the Chicago nightlife together since the Cubs played all-day games at Wrigley Field. Ruth Ann Steinhagen was born 2 days before Christmas on December 23, 1929. She was the daughter of a die setter, Walter Steinhagen, and his homemaker wife, Edith, both of whom had immigrated from Berlin in the early 1920s. Ruth was a quiet, nervous child who kept to herself. She had a couple of good friends in high school, but was generally quiet and reserved. At times, she seemed to live in her own little world. Ruth spent 2 years at Waller High School before earning a high school diploma at Jones Commercial High School. Like most girls her age, she loved the movies, music, and baseball. She fell in love with actor Alan Ladd and would clip every article she could find about him in popular movie magazines. For a time, she was obsessed with former Our Gang star and Chicago Cub outfielder Peanut Lowry. She joined his fan club, which mainly consisted of talking to girls her own age about the baseball player. Ruth's parents were quite concerned with her celebrity obsessions. They tried to tell themselves her fascination with movie stars and ball players was a phase, and she would grow out of it when she made new friends. April 2nd, 1947. This was a special day in Major League Baseball. The Yankees were having a special day to honor Babe Ruth. This day would take place at Yankee Stadium, but since the Bambino meant so much to the game, Major League Baseball made arrangements to broadcast the ceremony through all Major League ballparks. Ruth Ann decided to attend the Cubs game that day at Wrigley Field. She splurged for a box seat near first base. This would be the first time Ruth ever laid eyes on Eddie Waitkus. No one was aware of it at the time, but 17-year-old Ruth Ann had just begun her descent into madness. Baseball Annies are a fixture on the pro baseball circuit, waiting for the players in the hotel bar, leaning over the railing near the dugout, loitering near the team bus in the parking lot. They arrived to games early and stay long after the final out to meet a player. They would pass notes and phone numbers through bat boys or clubhouse guys. Some think the term Baseball Annie came from the Susan Sarandon character in Bull Durham, but the term predates the popular baseball movie by at least 40 years. Wherever there are professional baseball players, there have been women eager to meet them. Baseball Annies wanted nothing less than to meet and marry a ball player. These women were called Annie or Sadie or Shirley, polite and affectionate names for baseball groupies. Sometimes they find out where players are staying on the road and show up to the bar, said former Giants pitcher Sean Estes. Some women get obsessed. I've gotten faxes and flowers. It can get a little weird, but it's not as common as it used to be, from what I understand. Houston Astros manager Dusty Baker also claims times have changed a lot when it comes to young ladies chasing ball players. Now, that could be something players say to help their wives sleep easier at night. After that April day, it wasn't long before Ruth Ann was totally obsessed with her new object of affection, Chicago's first baseman, Eddie Waitkus. Ruth's parents even noticed a change in her. Eddie was all that their daughter would talk about. And Ruth was compulsive when it came to Eddie. Ruth would later say, "I liked Eddie because he was clean-cut and I liked the way he played baseball. I was in love with him." Ruth built a shrine to Eddie in her bedroom. There were newspaper articles, pictures, and a large teddy bear she named Eddie that she hugged each night. She talked about Eddie constantly and regularly bought tickets for seats near first base at Wrigley Field. She would arrive to the ballpark early to watch him take batting practice. She was also often the last fan to leave the park. She hung out near the clubhouse, sometimes in the pouring rain, hoping for a glimpse of her idol. Her obsession was such that she bought maps of Cambridge, his hometown. She would tell anyone who would listen that she and Eddie would marry one day and live on Portland Street where he was born. Ruth even went so far as to buy a copy of Eddie's high school yearbook. All of this, of course, without Eddie knowing of her existence. For their part, Ruth's mother urged her to seek the help of a psychiatrist. This was something the Chicago Tribune would later report. In fact, Ruth did consult with a psychiatrist, two of them. But her behavior didn't change. Her father, Walter, tried to persuade her to forget about Waitkus, according to the Tribune, but his suggestions only upset her. Ruth received a jolt on December 14, 1948, when the Chicago Cubs traded Eddie to the Philadelphia Phillies. Eddie hated leaving Chicago. He loved his life in the Second City. But this would give him a chance to play back on the East Coast, closer to his father and sister. When she learned of the trade, Ruth cried for days, and her sadness soon turned to anger. She saw this as a betrayal, as if Eddie's trade to Philadelphia was personal. She saw it as Eddie rejecting her. A month later, in January 1949, Ruth left her parents' home. She moved into an apartment which she filled with mementos of Eddie Waitkus, and she worked as a typist for an insurance company. In May of 1949, Ruth decided she would kill Eddie Waitkus. She told her mother and a friend of her intentions, but they didn't think she was serious. "I guess I got the idea to shoot him because he reminded me of my father," Ruth would later tell the court. According to the New York Times, Ruth also said, "I was building in my mind the idea of killing him. As time went on, I just became nuttier and nuttier about the guy. I knew I would never get to know him in a normal way, so I kept thinking, I will never get him, and if I can't have him, nobody else can. Then I decided I would kill him." In early summer, Ruth saw the Phillies were headed to Chicago to play the Cubs. Days later, Ruth went to a pawn shop and paid $21 for a .22 caliber rifle. She told the pawnbroker she needed the gun for protection. He showed her how to disassemble the .22 and put it back together. Then, Ruth reserved a room at the same hotel where the Phillies stayed, and she registered as Ruth Ann Burns of Boston. Ruth told police she got the rifle into the hotel by separating it into two parts. "I wrapped the parts in newspaper and put them in my traveling bag and brought it to the hotel." She also brought along a paring knife with a 3.5-inch blade. "I was planning to stab him," Ruth said. She intended to use the gun to commit suicide. In her hotel room, Ruth reassembled the rifle, loaded it with one cartridge, and placed it in a closet. And on June 14, 1949, the Phillies played the Cubs at Wrigley Field. Eddie had a single, a walk, and scored twice in the Phillies' 9-2 triumph. The Tuesday afternoon game drew 7,815 spectators, including 19-year-old Ruth Ann Steinhagen. After the game, Ruth went back to her hotel room. Meanwhile, Eddie went to a restaurant for dinner with friends. While he was out, Ruth tipped a bellhop $5 and asked him to deliver a note to Eddie. With her plan put together, Ruth ordered 2 whiskey sours and a daiquiri from room service. She settled in with her drinks and waited for Eddie to respond. When Eddie returned to the hotel, the bellhop informed him a woman left a note for him at the front desk. The unsigned note asked Eddie to please come to room 1297A. The note read, "It is extremely important that I see you as soon as possible. We're not acquainted, but I have something of importance to speak to you about. I think it would be to your advantage to let me explain it to you." The note concluded by saying, "Please come soon. I won't take too much of your time." There was something about the note that made Eddie uneasy. He asked the hotel clerk who room 1297-A was registered to. He was told Ruth Ann Burns of Cambridge, Boston. Eddie seemed to recall a Ruth Ann Burns from high school. And he was right. Ruth Ann had taken the name from a young woman in Eddie's yearbook. Eddie showed his teammates the strange note and finally decided he should call on her, thinking she might be a family acquaintance in need of help. First, Eddie phoned the room. He thought Ruth Ann may have been asleep, but she urged him to come up, and it was nearly 11:30 when he knocked on the door. Ruth invited Eddie in. He entered the room and walked past her, sitting down in a chair by the window. Ruth picked up the rifle and said, "I have a surprise for you. You're not going to bother me anymore." Eddie stiffened and said, "What goes on here? Is this some kind of joke? What have I done?" She responded by shooting at Eddie, and the bullet struck him in the abdomen. As Eddie collapsed, he said, "Oh, baby, why did you do that?" Ruth wasn't convinced she'd shot Eddie, but eventually stepped over his body, returned the gun to the closet, and called the front desk, saying that she had just shot a man in her room. This phone call would save Eddie's life. The bullet had pierced his lung and was lodged near Eddie's spine. He would undergo 2 operations before being transferred to Billings Memorial Hospital on the University of Chicago campus, where he had a 3rd operation. It was there that Eddie developed a persistent fever. It was determined he needed another operation, this time to remove the bullet. While Eddie fought for his life, Ruth was indicted for attempted murder. However, she was declared mentally ill and committed to the Kankakee State Hospital, where Ruth would remain for 3 years. She was confined and treated at the institution until 1952, when she was declared cured and was released. Eddie Waitkus did not press charges against Ruth after she was released, telling an assistant state's attorney that he wanted to forget the incident. Fortunately, Eddie's recovery was near miraculous. He spent a month in the hospital before returning to Philadelphia on July 17th. When his flight landed, he found 500 fans had braved the pouring rain to greet him. But Eddie was never the same after the shooting. He displayed symptoms that now would indicate he was suffering from PTSD. But this was 80 years ago, and there were few who recognized the disorder. Eddie started to shy away from crowds. He hated entering and leaving the ballpark. He would play pro ball for a few more years, but he was never the same. Eddie did settle down and get married in the 1950s. The couple had 2 children, but the marriage didn't last. Eddie's drinking became more of a problem, as did his depression, which he had battled since the shooting. Now he self-medicated his deepening depression with alcohol. Eddie played until 1955, when he retired from the game. After his divorce in 1960, he moved back to Cambridge to be closer to his sister. In the fall of 1971, Eddie fractured his hip when he fell while installing storm windows on the second story of the house where he rented a room. Although he had quit drinking, he continued to be a heavy smoker. In the summer of 1972, Eddie felt so poorly he entered the VA hospital in Jamaica Plain with pneumonia. He was diagnosed with esophageal cancer and would never leave the hospital. Eddie Waitkus died September 16, 1972. He was 53 years old. As for Ruth, after her release from psychiatric care, she rented a small apartment in Chicago and worked at an insurance office for the next 35 years. She never married and lived alone the remainder of her life. Ruth Ann Steinhagen died December 29, 2012, in a Chicago hospital. She'd suffered a subdural hematoma after an accidental fall in her home. Author Bernard Malamud used the basic elements of this story in his 1952 best-selling novel, The Natural. The book was later made into a major motion picture starring Robert Redford. The Deadball podcast is written by Tim Scott and edited by Chuck Walters. If you'd like to connect with like-minded baseball fans, check out the Deadball podcast discussion group on Facebook.